This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
In the Greek imagination, there are few figures who sit more uneasily between history and legend than Pythagoras. Say his name today and most people think of a schoolroom diagram, a right triangle, some letters along its sides, and the neat little relation, a squared plus b squared equals c squared. But if you were to step into a meeting of his followers in southern Italy in the late 6th century BCE, the man at the center of that future textbook figure would look nothing like a harmless geometry teacher. He would seem more like a founder of a religious order, a philosopher of cosmic harmony, and the leader of a disciplined community that treated numbers as the key, not just to triangles, but to the structure of the soul and the order of the entire universe. Pythagoras was born on the island of Samos, off the coast of Asia Minor, sometime around 570 BCE. The island lay within the same cultural orbit as Miletus, where Phales, Anaximander, and Anaximenes thought about water, the Apeiron, and air. Yet the trajectory of Pythagoras's life carried him in a different direction. Ancient reports disagree about the details of his biography, and his own writings, if any, have been swallowed by time. Much of what we know comes from later sources mixing fact with imaginative reconstruction. Still, the outline is clear enough. A gifted and inquisitive youth travels to Egypt and perhaps further east, initiation into various religious and mystical traditions, a return to Greece, and finally a move to the west, to the Greek colony of Croton in southern Italy, where he founded the community that would carry his name. In Samos, he would have grown up amid the typical mixture of Greek religion, local cults, and early philosophical talk, drifting west from Ionia. But Pythagoras seems to have been restless. Later biographies portray him as a seeker who studied with Egyptian priests, learned from Babylonian wise men, and possibly encountered ideas from Persia or even India, though direct links are much harder to prove than storytellers like to pretend. What matters philosophically is that his mind became saturated with a sense of the sacred and a fascination with ritual purity, reincarnation, and the hidden order behind visible things. Unlike the Milesians, who stand primarily in the line of natural science, Pythagoras is at once a rational investigator and a religious reformer. When he eventually settled in Croton, he did not simply open a school in the way later philosophers would do in Athens. He established something closer to a way of life. Those who came to him were not just students, but initiates. They were expected to live communally, to undergo a period of silence, to submit to rules about diet, dress, and behavior, and to treat the teachings of the master as a kind of revelation. Their community had an inner circle sworn to secrecy and an outer ring of sympathizers. They entered public life in Croton, advising on political matters and promoting a certain ethical, almost ascetic, style of existence. To join them was to have your life reorganized around a new vision of the cosmos. At the heart of that vision was a single disarming claim that the true nature of things can be grasped through number and ratio. The Milesians had spoken of water and air, of the indefinite and its separations. Pythagoras and his followers said, in effect, that behind these material forms lie numerical relations. This is not just the insight that you can measure things. It is the more radical idea that numbers are not merely convenient human tools for counting and comparing, but the very structure of reality itself. Where others had looked for a first material principle, the Pythagoreans looked for an abstract order that could be expressed in whole numbers and simple fractions. The legendary image that captures this shift is simple and powerful. Pythagoras, we are told, listened to the sounds produced by blacksmiths, hammers striking anvils, and noticed that some pairs of notes sounded more harmonious than others. Curious, he investigated. In another version, it is the sound of plucked strings stretched to different lengths across a simple wooden frame, a kind of primitive monochord. What he found, or was later said to have found, was that pleasing musical intervals correspond to simple numerical ratios between string lengths or tensions, 2:1 for the octave, 3:2 for the perfect fifth, 4:3 for the perfect fourth. Harmony, in other words, is number made audible. Whether Pythagoras himself did these experiments is impossible to know, but they express something real about the Pythagorean imagination. Music, that deeply emotional and seemingly intangible art, turns out to obey exact proportion. When you shorten a string by half, you hear the octave. When you adjust it to 2/3 of its length, you hear the fifth. The human ear, guided by taste and culture, delights in these patterns, but the patterns themselves are indifferent to us. They would exist whether or not anyone noticed them. To discover them is to glimpse a world where beauty and mathematical simplicity coincide. From there, the Pythagoreans extended the insight outward. If the ear loves simple ratios, perhaps the eye does too. The shapes that we call beautiful, the regular solids, the symmetrical figures, might be obeying a similar hidden arithmetic. The cosmos as a whole, they suggested, is arranged according to number. Some later Pythagoreans imagined the planets and stars as moving in such ordered paths that their motions form an inaudible music of the spheres, a cosmic harmony too constant and all-encompassing for limited human ears to detect. We do not hear it, they said, for the same reason we do not hear the sound of our own blood always moving. It is there always. So we have no contrast by which to notice it. If there is something mystical in these ideas, there is also something recognizably scientific. To say that the structure of a musical scale can be expressed in ratios is to take a step that, in the very long run, will make physics possible. To say that the motions of celestial bodies might form a regular system gives birth to astronomy as a mathematical craft. The difference in tone between Pythagoras and the Milesians is real, but the direction of travel is not so different. Both seek an underlying order that makes the world intelligible. For Pythagoras, however, the order is not just explanatory, it is also normative. To live well is to live in harmony with the numerical structure of things. That conviction spilled over into every area of the Pythagorean way of life. They cultivated certain virtues: moderation, self-control, loyalty, reverence for the divine, and expressed them in rules that ranged from the clearly ethical to the seemingly arbitrary. They practiced communal property among the inner circle, adopting the phrase, "the goods of friends are common." They avoided certain foods, most famously beans, for reasons that remain obscure and were likely symbolic or tied to ritual purity. They believed in the transmigration of souls, the notion that after death, the soul can be reborn in other bodies, human or animal, and that one's conduct in this life shapes one's destiny in the next. This belief justified vegetarian practices among some of them. If animals might house the souls of former humans or future friends, eating flesh becomes morally fraught. Pythagoras himself was revered almost as a semi-divine figure by his followers. Stories circulated that he could remember his own past lives, that he had been a warrior at Troy, that he recognized a friend's soul in the eyes of a dog and told the animal not to be beaten. Anecdotes told of his uncanny abilities, knowing when earthquakes would strike, calming storms at sea, curing illnesses with music. These stories are impossible to verify and may tell us more about the needs of his followers than about the man himself. Yet they illustrate the peculiar role he played, a thinker whose authority depended not only on argument, but on charisma, legend, and the promise of spiritual transformation. Amid the swirl of reverence and rulemaking, the more familiar Pythagorean theorem appears as almost a side note. The relation between the sides of a right triangle was known in Babylonian mathematics before Pythagoras's time, as surviving clay tablets attest. What is new in the Greek context is not the bare relation. Some lengths work together in a 3-4-5 triangle, but the effort to prove it generally within a deductive geometric system. Whether Pythagoras himself supplied such a proof, or whether it emerged within the broader Pythagorean school, is debated. But the association of his name with the theorem captures something true. The community around him helped crystallize the Greek style of doing mathematics, starting from simple postulates and definitions, deriving theorems with rigorous logical steps, and treating geometry as a window into the structure of reality. For the Pythagoreans, the theorem was not just a property of triangles. It was a glimpse of a world where relations hold with necessity. If a right triangle has legs of lengths A and B, then the square on the hypotenuse will always equal the sum of the squares on the legs. No god can decree otherwise. No whim can alter it. In drawing the diagram and following the reasoning, the mind comes into contact with something it experiences as timeless. That feeling that there are truths independent of the flux of events would later become central to Plato's philosophy. It is no accident that Plato is deeply influenced by Pythagorean ideas. In his dialogues, mathematics becomes a training for the mind's ascent from the world of changeable appearances to the stable realm of forms. Yet the Pythagorean encounter with number was not entirely reassuring. Within the same school that so praised whole numbers and simple ratios, a discovery emerged that must have felt like a small earthquake. The realization that the diagonal of a square cannot be expressed as a ratio of whole numbers. If you draw a square whose sides are each one unit long, the Pythagorean theorem tells you that the diagonal has length the square root of 2. But when the Pythagoreans tried to express that length as a fraction, a ratio of two integers, they found that no such fraction could capture it exactly. The number was incommensurable with the unit. There was no shared measure that would make both the side and the diagonal whole number multiples of it. Legend has it that this discovery was so shocking that the Pythagoreans tried to keep it secret, and that the member who revealed it outside the circle was punished by drowning. Whether or not that gruesome detail is true, the sense of crisis was real. A community that believed that all is number, where number meant whole integers and their ratios, had discovered magnitudes that cannot be expressed that way. The smooth harmony of their cosmos had a fissure running through it. Later Greek mathematicians would develop a more sophisticated understanding of irrational numbers, but for the Pythagoreans, this was a sign that the world is more complex than their initial enthusiasm for neat ratios had suggested. In a way, that tension between the clarity of mathematical order and the resistant complexity of reality runs through the entire Pythagorean legacy. On the one hand, they bequeath to Western thought the idea that the book of nature is written in the language of mathematics, that number underpins form, structure, and change. On the other hand, they encounter, at the very edge of their own work, a reminder that not everything fits cleanly into whole number patterns. The diagonal of the square, the stubborn irrational, becomes a symbol of the irrational in a broader sense, that which eludes tidy conceptual schemes. The political fate of the Pythagorean community in Croton adds another layer to the story. For a time, their influence in the city seems to have been considerable. They promoted a kind of aristocratic republicanism, favoring rule by the wise and virtuous. Their discipline, mutual loyalty, and air of higher knowledge made them both impressive and threatening to others. Eventually, resentment grew. In one version of events, a popular uprising targeted the Pythagoreans, meeting houses were burned, members killed or driven out. Pythagoras himself, already old, is said to have died in exile or in the turmoil. The Pythagorean movement did not vanish, but it scattered across southern Italy and Greece, its teachings diffusing and evolving in new settings. That scattering had paradoxical effects, freed from the immediate authority of the founder and the tight communal structure of Croton. Pythagorean ideas mingled more freely with other strains of Greek thought. Some later Pythagoreans leaned into the mystical side, elaborating number symbolism in ways that to a modern reader look like elaborate numerology. Others focused on mathematics and astronomy, contributing to the development of those disciplines. The notion that the soul is a harmony of the body, or that living well means bringing one's passions into proportion, seeped into moral philosophy. By the time Plato and later Plotinus wrote, it was hard to untangle where Pythagoras ended and broader Greek speculation about number, harmony, and the soul began. From the standpoint of a modern listener being introduced to the history of philosophy, Pythagoras is a figure of productive ambiguity. Is he a scientist or a mystic, a mathematician or a religious leader, a discoverer of musical ratios or a promoter of reincarnation tales? The answer is that he and his school were all of these at once. The categories that separate these roles in our minds were not yet settled in his world. To say that the soul is immortal and migrates from body to body was, for him, not in tension with investigating the geometry of triangles. To say that numbers are. The essence of things did not mean abandoning ethics. It meant translating ethical questions into the language of harmony and proportion. If you were to shape a bonus episode around him, you might want to invite the listener into that older, less compartmentalized frame. Picture the scene of the monochord experiment, the way the pitch rises as the string shortens, the delight at finding fixed ratios behind pleasing chords. Then shift to the hush of the Pythagorean meeting hall, where initiates rise before dawn, eat simple food, listen to discourses about the transmigration of souls, and chant or listen to carefully chosen melodies as a kind of therapy for the soul. Show how the same mind that delights in proof also believes that certain patterns of sound can bring the psyche back into balance, just as tuning the strings of a lyre can restore consonance. You could too. Draw a line from Pythagoras to our own fascination with patterns. We no longer talk much about the music of the spheres, but we send instruments into space to measure cosmic background radiation, gravitational waves, and orbital resonances, and then translate those measurements into graphs and sounds. We still feel a strange awe when the data falls into clear mathematical form, whether in the regular spacing of planetary orbits or the spectral lines of atoms. At such moments, we are closer to the Pythagorean mood than we might admit. We feel that there is something beautiful about simplicity, something almost sacred about a well-fitting equation. But we also live with the Pythagorean disappointment. We know, as they began to suspect, that the patterns are not always simple, that chaos and complexity have their own stubborn place in the cosmos. Yet even our theories of chaos are written in mathematics. In that sense, part of Pythagoras's dream has come true in ways he could not have imagined. The world does yield to numerical description. The question is no longer whether number underpins reality, but how far that underpinning goes. One detail that later writers loved to stress is the central symbol of Pythagorean devotion, the tetractys, a triangular arrangement of the first four numbers, 1, 2, 3, and 4, whose sum is 10. They would inscribe it as a triangle of dots. One at the top, then a row of 2, then 3, then 4 beneath. This simple figure became for them a kind of sacred emblem. The number 10, the sum of 1 through 4, was treated as the perfect number, a symbol of completeness. 1 stands for unity, the source, 2 for division and otherness, 3 for the synthesis that emerges from tension, 4 for the solidity of the world, with its 4 directions and seasons. To swear an oath by the tetractys was, in Pythagorean circles, to call upon the very structure of reality as witness. The tetractys was not just an abstract charm, it provided a framework for thinking about opposites. Another Pythagorean teaching spoke of a table of paired contraries, limited and unlimited, odd and even, one and many, right and left, male and female, rest and motion, straight and curved, light and dark, good and bad. These oppositions, they thought, run through every aspect of the world. To understand any phenomenon is to see how these paired principles are at work in it, how limit is being imposed on the unlimited, how unity emerges from multiplicity. Here again, ethical and cosmological reflection intertwine. To live well as a human being is, in part, to side with limit rather than excess, with measure rather than unbounded appetite. But it is also to recognize that the unlimited has its place as the raw material out of which form must be carved. This way of framing things helps explain why the Pythagoreans were so preoccupied with discipline. They were not merely following arbitrary rules for their own sake. They saw themselves as enacting in their daily routines the very patterns they believed structured the cosmos. Rising at regular hours, eating simple food in measured portions, restraining anger and desire, practicing periods of silence and reflection. These were ways of tuning themselves like instruments. Just as a musician checks the interval between strings against a known ratio, the Pythagorean aspirant checked their habits against an ideal of proportion. Excessive grief, excessive laughter, indulgence in food or sex, impulsive speech, all would be signs that one's inner harmony was off. There are tantalizing hints that women played an important role in this community. Names like Phiano, Damo, and Mia appear in later lists of Pythagorean writers or disciples. Some ancient authors attribute treatises on household management, child rearing, and virtue to female Pythagoreans, though it is hard to know how reliable these attributions are. Still, the mere presence of these names suggests that the circle around Pythagoras was less strictly male than many later philosophical schools. If true, this would fit with their emphasis on the soul's immortality and transmigration. If the same soul can live many lives in different kinds of bodies, the strict social hierarchies of gender and status lose some of their metaphysical weight. The virtues of self-control, justice, and harmony would apply to men and women alike. Daily life in the Pythagorean community, as reconstructed from later testimony, had a distinct rhythm. Newcomers might spend years as akousmatikoi, listeners, bound to hear and memorize the master's sayings without yet being initiated into the deeper explanations. Only after proving themselves through silence, obedience, and the adoption of Pythagorean habits would they become mathematikoi, students of learning, and be allowed to engage in open discussion and inquiry. This staged initiation mirrored their broader view of education. The soul must first be shaped by habituation and reverence before it can fruitfully grasp the reasons behind things. Knowledge without discipline, they feared, would lead to arrogance rather than wisdom. Within this structure, mathematics had a strange double role. On the one hand, it was a high intellectual pursuit, training the mind to think with clarity about necessary truths. On the other, it was almost liturgical, part of the community's spiritual practice. Contemplating numerical relations was a way of aligning oneself with the divine order. The Pythagoreans did not yet have anything like our modern separation between pure and applied mathematics. To work out a geometric proof or explore numerical patterns in musical harmony was at once an exercise of reason and a kind of devotion. The influence of Pythagorean ideas on Plato is clearest in dialogues like the Timaeus, where the structure of the cosmos is described in terms of geometrical solids and mathematical ratios, and in the Republic, where the education of the guardians includes a long course in arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and harmonics. Plato takes over the thought that the visible world is shaped by intelligible forms that can be grasped best through mathematical thinking. He also inherits and transforms the Pythagorean intuition that the soul is akin to the order of the heavens. When Socrates in the Phaedo speaks of the philosopher as someone who practices dying and death by detaching the soul from the body's distractions, one can hear distant Pythagorean tones about reincarnation and the soul's journey. Much later, in the Hellenistic and Roman periods, so-called Neo-Pythagoreans revived and elaborated the old doctrines. They combined Pythagorean number symbolism with Platonic metaphysics and various Eastern religious currents, producing a lush synthesis in which numbers, planets, medals, virtues, and divine names all corresponded. For them, the monad, the dyad, and the decad were not just counters, but living principles. The Pythagorean idea that the cosmos is structured harmonically became part of a broader mystical vision in which ascending through the levels of number and being could lead the soul back to its divine source. From a historical standpoint, this later blossoming of Pythagoreanism makes it harder to see what belongs to the earliest layer and what is later accretion. But from a philosophical standpoint, it testifies to the generative power of the questions the early Pythagoreans posed. Once the thought has taken root that number, harmony, and proportion have something essential to do with what is real and what is good, there are countless ways to develop it. Some pathways lead toward the austere clarity of Euclidean geometry. Others lead toward speculative cosmologies in which every detail of the world is read as a numerical sign. It is tempting to make a stark choice between the serious Pythagoras, the proto-scientist, the discoverer of musical ratios and geometric theorems, and the esoteric Pythagoras, the reincarnation believer, the number mystic, the leader of a semi-secret sect. But to do that is to impose our own categories too rigidly on a world where they did not yet apply. In his time, the drive to find exact patterns and the desire for spiritual purification were not separate projects. They sprang from the same sense that the world has a hidden order and that the human soul can, with effort, bring itself into tune with that order. We can perhaps understand him better if we think of moments in our own experience when understanding and transformation feel intertwined. A musician who finally grasps the structure of a difficult piece and feels, in playing it well, a deep emotional release. A mathematician who spends months wrestling with a problem and experiences the solution as not just an intellectual victory, but a personal one. An individual who, after living chaotically, imposes new structure on their days and feels their mind clear. These are tiny echoes of the Pythagorean conviction that order is both true and healing. That conviction, as much as any particular doctrine, is what makes Pythagoras an enduring figure in the history of philosophy. Even when we have abandoned his specific cosmology, we still argue about whether the most profound truths are likely to be simple and elegant, or messy and irreducible, whether beauty is a reliable guide to truth, whether a well-ordered life is necessarily a better one. The Pythagorean answer leans strongly to one side of those questions. Yes, the real is harmonious. Yes, beauty and simplicity reveal something about the way things are. Yes. The soul thrives when its parts are arranged in proportion. To explore his thought is to confront those intuitions in one of their earliest and most influential forms. When you strip away the legends about golden thighs and talking rivers, you are left with a man whose followers heard in the plucked string and the turned triangle hints of a deeper pattern. That pattern, they believed, governed not only sound and shape, but birth and death, character and fate. Whether or not we share their faith in reincarnation or their dietary scruples, we can recognize in their work the beginning of a long dialogue between mathematics, music, ethics, and metaphysics. Pythagoras stands near the start of that conversation, a faint but persistent voice reminding us that for human beings, the search for truth has always been entangled with the search for a way to live.
Midnight rails under silver moon, dusty boots on a winding road. A shadow's the only friend I've known since she packed up and let me go. Empty whiskey bottle on the sea, her laugh still echoes in my bones. Saddle's heavy with memories. I ride alone where the wind still blows. Nowhere else to be. 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 Sunrise paints the horizon gold, but it don't warm a lonesome soul. Every town I pass feels half her size. Every trail's haunted by goodbye. I whisper prayers to open skies, hoping someday my heart'll find a brand new path beyond the pain, where broken hearts can heal in time. Nowhere else to be. 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 Thank you.